Round one. Fight!
This is episode 10 of Don't Be a Scrub podcast. My name is Spider Carnage, aka Verbose Mute on Xbox Live. My interviewing partner is Muttonhead01 on Xbox and PSN. Episode 10 is a milestone for Don't Be a Scrub podcast. We've actually made it to double digits. To tell you the truth, I'm actually surprised we made it this far. Both Mutton and I have had a lot of fun producing this show. We're hoping that you guys are actually enjoying the show so far. I'd like to point out that we both will be covering Marvel 3 and still continue to cover Street Fighter 4 and basically general fighting games. Although Marvel is quite an interesting game, the fighting system is very, very different to the Street Fighter series. And I think it's actually good because the community now actually has two games to play rather than just one. So we had significant turnout for Marvel and for Street Fighter both at Deacon and Chris's Clubhouse. And I think that this trend will probably continue on with the new Couch Warriors season coming up this month. This episode's interview is interesting from a perspective that, yes, we cover the usual Street Fighter and fighting game genres, but we also actually delve into a little bit more into the video game industry in general, video game journalism, and what video game shows are out there. And how the Australian media is actually focusing on video games, which I think is actually, it does actually tie into the fighting games quite a lot. And I actually personally have quite a big interest in video game journalism and media in Australia, because I think only with their help can the actual fighting game series be taken seriously, become something similar to StarCraft. As always, you can find a full transcript of the interview on Mutton's blog, being at scrub.wordpress.com, and we hope you enjoy the interview.
Back! You're listening to the Don't Be a Scrub podcast. Stay hungry, stay salty, and continue listening.
Fourth recording location, Nando's across from Box Hill.
AKA our second studio.
Second studio is my car.
Yeah, so it's our third studio.
Third studio is Deacon, and the fourth one is this.
Yeah. I'll have to correct you, because we're across the road from Blue House, not Box Hill.
That's right, Box
Hill. God, I'm a freaking tourist, and I know this town better than you, man.
It's true. And speaking of that, today our special guest is Mr. Moose King from South Australia.
What's up?
Moose King, so do you like Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Bullwinkle. As a kid, of course you did. You grew up watching like ABC and you see like Rocky and Bullwinkle and what else? Roger Ramjet, stuff like that. But
weekday afternoons.
Yeah, so like rats. Before 5 o'clock, it was just like before all these major cartoons, the 5 minute little shorts would come on. So yeah, of course I love old animation and stuff like that, but you know, that's not the basis for my name.
Oh, okay.
So what is the basis for your name?
You like moose?
Yeah, I do.
Do you like to eat moose?
I don't know. Everyone really goes through kind of phases in how they call themselves or how they've created their, you know, how they want to be known in, again, you know, like their handle.
Yeah. Yep.
So for me, for a very long time, it was Shadowblade, and that was named after a Dark Elf assassin in Warhammer.
Yeah.
And I was quite happy with that name for a very long time, and then it just kept sounding like I was trying too hard to be cool, or it just didn't sound like it reflected who I was. So it comes down to what you like, and I love animals, and Orangutan King didn't really sound too awesome. So, you know, my number two favorite animal in the world is the moose. Just because it's so clumsy looking, yet, you know, it's dangerous. You don't want to approach a moose in the wild, or, you know.
So wait a minute, so is your number one favorite animal orangutan?
Yes.
Why is your number one favorite animal orangutan? Do you like ginger ladies?
I do love ginger ladies, but I don't know. I just like the way they move and they just look so somber, I guess.
They're also the closest ape, like creature to man.
So you watch it, I've watched a lot of wildlife documentaries, and you know, they just interest me a lot, to what they do.
That's cool. But wait, so your second favorite animal is the moose.
Right.
So what do you think of the moose test? You know, the test they conduct where they hit a moose with their car.
Oh, really? I have no idea what the moose test is.
Because, like, you know, the moose has, like, spindly legs and a really fat body. So when a car hits the moose, like, normally the legs get broken right away, but the body flies into the windshield and you just die.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure they don't do that anymore. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the people would have shot that man.
Man, you're old, dude. Like, how long has that been going on for? That sounds like something that would have been done in the 70s.
I was going to say 60s, yeah.
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 Button's a wise old man.
No, man.
So you're an aspiring video game journalist?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us the state of the industry in Australia?
It's difficult to say because, you know, it takes a long time to go over everything, you know, up and down, inside and out, what goes on around Australia. But what I can just say is this, that most of the print journalism in Australia is fairly interwoven. Everyone knows each other. It's, you know, very well connected, and it's a little bit easier to get into as well. From a couple of friends that I had back in SA, you know, interstate as well, they got their breaks by write or posting that they want to write something for an event or for some sort of small thing that has to do with video games for Hyper in the Hyperactive forum online. And you know, that doesn't really serve well as an awesome website for Hyper magazine, yet it still served, it did a good enough job and still does a good enough job as being a good forum for most of the, I guess, video game savvy click in Australia. So that's how most people get their breaks in the video game. Other than that, you know, I would say that the video game industry media in Australia, for the very most part, suffers from token Australianism, in that they would rather point out facts like we love beer, or throw on a thicker Aussie accent, or the silly sort of mannerisms that you would associate with a down-to-earth Australian person.
Yep.
And they don't really take their job as, or don't apply the more serious spin or analytical spin that you would hope to see and expect. And when you take a look at, and you know, I'm being very general here, is that like Margaret and David at the movies are extremely well respected for their analytical process and breaking down and talking about movies and films in, you know, a very educated way. And you take a look at, you know, if you judge other video game shows or other video game podcasts or stuff like this based on that, then you don't really get that same sort of thing, at least in the mainstream media. And then on the other side of the coin, you have the overly hardcore or the too niche for their own good.
Okay, the fighting game community in Australia.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, because the fighting game community does outreach to other people a lot more. They're a lot more sociable than, you know, other communities are. But, you know, you get people who are so involved in their own sort of way of doing things that they forego that sort of natural exploration and asking questions and being really sociable with what they do. So it mainly comes from that sort of psychological thing about we're like the first generation to come through where there's been a real change in the tide in terms of this medium. Like, this is a brand spanking new medium, and the audience around it, we've taken it from, you know, this thing that you would only associate with children and, you know, as entertainment, like base entertainment for kids, to a high grossing sort of largely acceptable medium.
It's actually interesting the way you say that, because the video game industry has actually been outselling the movie industry since 2006.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think also the one point that really gets on my nerves and has taken Australia a very long time to catch up to is that you still get the people in the media today who would associate gaming and being a gamer as, you know, something unsociable or something, you know, taboo or that shouldn't be approached or done. And it's
also that it's a waste of time, that people who play these games are actually no good.
But you don't get that sort of spin with, you know, Triple J or Newzos and things like that, where they have that same level of passion for their medium, but they don't get chastised for it. In fact, it's celebrated a lot more on, like, stations like Triple J, and they came around from their passion for, you know, indie music and for just music in general, and they've made their way into, you know, mainstream home of...
So speaking of game journalism, what do you think of Good Games on ABC?
I did an internship with Good Games in 2009, and it's all right. It does what it needs to do in terms of the show, but that's not... You know, I think it could probably be a little better, a little bit more critical and a little less... Because they've branched off now. They've got Good Games, things here, Spawn Point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's on ABC 3. And they downplay it a lot more and they review child games and things like that. And they go for that sort of, you know, 5 to 15-year-old audience. The Good Games main show hasn't really stepped it up the other way and gone for analytical and... I guess mature perspective, and they still, I don't know, have these sort of silly idioms with what they do. And I guess it's just lost a bit. It's lost a bit of its bite since really lost his position. And
I thought he left one.
No, he didn't leave willingly. It was a whole big fiasco. I'm not really going to get into that. But that's not taking away anything from what Stephanie Bendixson does. But I watch it when I can. But it really doesn't pop out to myself or to other video game journalists as that must watch show or let's see what they think on this. And, you know, it's very much video game journalism for the more average person who doesn't really have an idea of what video games are.
Personally, I lost interest once when John Lewis left, because I used to watch it fairly regularly, because I actually used to watch there was an old video game show in Australia in 94, which used to review Genesis and SNES games. God, I can't remember the name of it. Something like Power. And for some reason, I don't know, I was sort of always looking for something, but Australia never had really too many video game review shows. And then I stumbled across Good Games in like 2000.
Good Games started when ABC2 popped up, and Janet Carr, the producer of Good Game, brought it to ABC2. And really, when digital television was taking off, they thought, hey, let's get in the ground floor here. We can probably do some really, really good work in establishing video games, considering, you know, their allocation and with the digital medium, like Gen Y and video games in general, play well with, you know, podcasts, they play well with internet savvy talk and things like that. So when digital television comes about and they're trying to go the alternate route, it makes sense to go for a video game show. And in that same sort of launch period as well, they had Thursday night dedicated to cult anime and stuff like that.
But that's right, they did too.
And I don't think that's running anymore. But
it seems like all the good things on TV tend to die off.
So what are your thoughts on fighting game commentary in general?
In general?
Yeah.
Are we talking Australia or worldwide?
Oh, both.
Worldwide? I think everyone has their taste in what they enjoy with commentary, and what I would like to see happen in terms of commentary, not just locally but internationally as well, is people taking this step up and actually looking at how you have broadcasters break down sport Like, take a look at Bruce Abernethy and Dennis Committee for AFL. They really work well together, and they really break down what's happening as well as call it when they need to, and they still have the right appropriate level of banter in between. So you've got some people who can't, who are too analytical and don't have enough personality in their voices behind what they're doing, and then you have others with too much personality and no real, you know, grasp of keeping their eye on the prize when it comes to breaking down a game or commentating on what needs to be commentated on. And this can be fixed with practice, and it's stuff that I actually do work on myself, and that's take a look back at how, you know, what you're saying, and kind of put it in the back of your mind of how you can have a different response to something, or how you can come up with a different talk point for what someone is doing, you know, in certain situations. You know, it's going to be a work in progress over the years, but I think Seth Killian is doing a fantastic job whenever he commentates, so long as he has someone with him, otherwise his voice gets a little bit dull. I think Keats does a very good job when it comes to the Verse series. Ski Sonic, I think, is unbelievable because he's actually able to do play-by-play for Marvel 2.
Which requires incredible speed.
Yeah. And, you know...
I think James Chen is also quite good.
Yeah, Jay Chen does a very good job because he has that personality, that flair and that passion behind his voice, that when you listen to him, he's not afraid to be excited over stuff. Like, and that's what you want. You want a broadcaster or a commentator to have that excitement because it's infectious when you listen to it. And the key is not to get too excited that, you know, you have a juice box apple gasm and you lose control of the ability to talk. You know, that's nothing against juice box because it's something that you need to work on. And, you know, talking, I do teams for Shadaloo Showdown. And doing play-by-play, or not even play-by-play, but commentating, you know, 10 games or something like that, it wears you out very, very quickly. Like, consistently having to think on your feet to come up with something to what's going on in, you know, a 3-minute match where you can have a large amount. You can break down a 3-minute match and it'll, you know, expand out to 25 minutes or something in terms of every single play that goes on there. So, you know, it's not easy to get into, and it's not easy to, in terms of develop and master it, but with practice, just like anything, is so long as you are aware of trying to increase your vocabulary and increase your, I guess, point of thought from, hey, this is something cool to, you know, to say, to actually coming out of your mouth.
Definitely.
You need to be able to have that sort of thought to voice really, you know, come out faster and work on that. I think that's the main thing to work on for fighting games, and the other one is to have, you know, the general insight that can play not just to the hardcore, but can be picked up on by anyone. So, you know, I think that might come with segments at the beginning of a cast or a video before it, where someone might break down, you know, what they're looking for, and similar to what they do with AFL, when they say, let's take a look at this matchup, what's going to go here. You might talk about, hey, let's take a look at who's to watch in this tournament. Let's see what their stats are. Let's also take a look at, you know, other tournaments where they've done well.
Yep,
break down, you know, their real go-to moves. But to that, you need a team behind you in terms of the analytical breakdown of what's happening, and then the voice to be the front for that team, which is really what commentary is. It's not just a one-man or two-man affair. It's a very, very large and involved process. So, you know, when you watch live streams and you see, like, Gutex chime in, I don't know if you guys watched, you know, the super hype match of the century in Neo versus Clockwork, but that was some of my favourite commentary, mainly because you had Justin chime in with fantastic insight as to what's happening. And I think Justin's commentary also did Clockwork in a little bit, because he said that
Neo should stop running away.
No, not Neo, but he's like, here's a tip that I only know about Clockwork or something like that he only blocks high, you know, and then one or two matches after that, Neo started landing all these combos from, you know, low hits. So, you know, I think someone was paying attention to the live stream and messaged
but
Neo.
That's also one important thing about commentary as well. So you don't actually give out information like that, because it's... I mean, it's good to a certain point, but you don't want to give, like...
This is the difference for it. When you're commentating for a live stream and for an audience... If you take a look at Evo, they have a live stage commentator, and then off to the side they have their stream commentators in terms of Keats and Ski Sonic, etc., etc. So the live commentator's role is to keep the audience entertained and have the hype and enthusiasm as in the, oh my god, what's going on, blah blah blah. And you can have the more analytical process behind on the live stream, which isn't going to interfere with the players, and the players aren't going to be able to listen to it and say, oh, hang on, he's right. That person is doing it. Because there needs to be that barrier between play and commentary. Yeah. So, you know, developing that from here and there, I think, for Australia, because we're, the Australian community is new to doing solid commentary. And what I was saying before about video game journalism, if you can really pull away from Australian mannerisms and things like that in your talk and thing, and really go for, you know, what needs to be done in terms of breaking something down or talking about something, rather than focus on the fact that you're Australian and then use that as your selling point, make sure you have the skills to be a fantastic commentator. And then afterwards it's a point, hey, that guy's Australian.
Yep.
Not Australia first, commentary second. Commentary first, Australia second.
Universalism first.
Then. Yeah, exactly. So get the job done first, and then bring in whatever flair that you need to on top of that, and weave it into your talk. That's what I think needs to be done.
So why get Street Fighter 4?
For me, I started out in SF4 with Ryu.
Just like everyone else.
I know, right? I come from, you know, a pad background in terms of, I've been playing fighting games since I was like 5, but the thing about Adelaide was it was never really easy for, you know, someone out in the suburbs who was young to go into town and go, hey, let's play at the arcade, spend lots of money and play with other people. So I had my brother and I had local friends who I used to play, you know, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat and things like that. And when... You know, I had consoles like Sega Saturn, Dreamcast, which had all these arcade perfect ports and, you know, I loved to the day. But, you know, I had no one to play with. So eventually, you know, when you're a kid, you've got, or during the early 90s, you have like after school care and these vacation care programs and things like this, where you'll meet up and, you know, someone might have a Genesis or a SNES or something like that, and you might play, you know, Street Fighter with them. And as a kid, I was always the guy that was to be beaten and that had like the 25 something thing. But I never advanced my game beyond that, like beyond me being like 7, 8, and 9. You know, and the game's changed over the years and I didn't really put in the time to really learn the aspects of every single game. It was just, hey, cool, look what I can do. I can do a freaking level 3 A-ism combo or something like that. But
I know exactly where you're coming from.
When SF4 dropped around, I was like, oh my god, thank god fighting games are back. But when I actually started looking at the people online, you know, I started thinking to myself, why aren't I playing in similar ways to that? How come I'm being beaten by this? Or, and that's where I took this, you know, the first steps going, I have to try out Stick because I don't have the, you know, the flawless input on pad. And Stick seems to be the go in terms of tournaments and things like that. Let's go to that. So when that happened and I invested time, I thought to myself, what characters really suit my sort of talk? And before I played SF4, I played Virtual Fighter 5. And I'm still involved to some extent with Virtual Fighter right now, but without you know, a console release for Final Showdown, and you know, it's just heartbreaking to tell you the truth of what's gone on the past couple of years with Sega and Virtual Fighter, but
Sega in general.
So I in VF, when you learn a character and you work at learning and mastering your character, you know, each character has 110 plus moves or something like that. So went from this complex sort of game to Street Fighter, which is, you know, when you count the state of everyone's high lows, like high, you know, medium punches, light punch thing, you've got maybe, I don't know, like 60, something like that. And for me, that wasn't enough. I wanted more in my sort of repertoire to be able to use. It's just unfortunate that even though Gen has that, and that was my immediate appeal to him, is that he can be tricky, I can mix it up with my stances and do sort of cool shit. But then Capcom didn't really think about it thoroughly enough, and in Vanilla, he had a lot of solid Mantis combos, which is his punch stance, which is his, you know, medium kick hands loops. Then they took that out and tried to bring back, you know, improve fundamentals for Gen, and they fucked up hard. And
indeed,
you know, they gave his crane stance some good tools, and you know, some better working on his normals, and then they took away, they overkilled his game for Mantis, and they really just, it really frustrates me, because this boiled my blood to a point where I actually couldn't, you know, cohesively talk about it without raging behind Capcom's logic behind the nerfs again. But yeah, that sense is fundamental why I like to play again, and it's yeah, I just like the trickery that he has and the large amount of moves he has for it. And you know, he plays similar to a Shoto as well, and he's got a DP, and you know, he's got the fast input press of say thing, and then he's got charge moves in terms of dives and rolls. So you know, he's a jack of all trades but master of none. And
so speaking of the dives, how do you get out the vertical ceiling dive?
Vertical ogre, you either beat before I get to the wall.
But what if you're knocked down?
If I knock you down from sweep or ultra, block. That's it. Because if you dash either way, again, player can pick it and change the vertical ogre direction and catch you.
But no, if he's trying to chip me out and he knocks me down,
dash.
So I can dash out of the
street. Wake up, dash. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's only on if you tech assist. If you if you're like untechable knockdown, might eat that chip damage. In that case, you have to roll the dice and do either an EX something, or you know, something that can be FADC'd, or something that has invisibility on your
startup.
But even then, ogre's recovery, unless it's difficult. But you know, it likely is going to be chip. So you know, if I beat you with super into ultra and you're left on a tiny bit of life, I can just go ogre drop in. And chip you out.
So what I do, I just have to EX out of it.
You play Ryu, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, it's going to be like EX DP or something like that.
But that means I'm going to whiff and you're going to punish me.
Yep.
Either way. Like, it comes to a point where if the Gen player times it right, you can't get out of it.
It even beats DJ's EX up kicks.
Really? I thought nothing beats that move.
No, it does, because it hits me right on top of the head. It's my vulnerable hitbox.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about AE, but in Super, definitely.
Okay.
Sad face. More reasons why DJ sucks.
So, you've mentioned wanting to go live in Japan someday, teach English there, so you want to talk about that a little bit?
I deferred from my degree at university, which was a double degree in journalism and international studies.
Yep.
And it's kind of been a long pursuit of mine to learn Japanese and to not just learn it, but you know, find a way of applying it in day-to-day life, and you're not really going to get that in Australia. So I'm not, like, you can earn big money from teaching English for a few years in Japan.
Yep.
So that's what I would like to do, and to go over there in Japan and just immerse myself into somewhere different, somewhere where, I don't know, you can throw yourself in and see really what you're made of in terms of trying to find your way around and reestablish yourself outside of what you're used to.
Yeah, outside your comfort zone, basically. Yeah.
So that's pretty much my real ambition to go there, is to really, I don't know, see what I can do and, I don't know, enjoy myself.
Okay. Are you going to play any Street Fighter when you're over there?
Yeah, definitely.
Of course.
Like,
cardinal
but
said
what
not
gets, to. What if he gets stuck in like out in the boonies and you can't play in the city arcade?
Dude, I'll take a train or whatever it is. I'll make sure that at least once a weekend or something I'll fly into a...
Right.
Or go to the capital city.
Unlike Australia, they actually have decent public transport.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of Gen, what do you think of characters having different, you know, maximum health?
I think it's...
What's your opinion on that?
You know, don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure in Virtual Fighter everyone has the same amount of health.
Same
right?
Like Tekken, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just that the heavier characters do more damage, and the light characters do less. And, but in Street Fighter it works. To a certain degree it does. It's just, you have to be able to give those light characters an option to either A, have something to get out, which in vanilla was Gen's EX Ogre having full invincibility, which, you know, a lot of people think is overpowered, but it's just like teleport in the fact that, you know, if you know it's coming, you can move back a little bit and you can punish it. But Capcom obviously thought different and they removed that altogether. And then they gave him a shitty DP, which, you know, doesn't do anything. But
it's hard to option select.
Gen has the same amount of health as Akuma, and
yeah.
Akuma has teleport. Akuma has
ridiculous,
you know, FADCs. He's got, you know, demon flips. He's got just about anything that he needs to get out of a situation, and yet Gen doesn't have anything. And I think Capcom have favoritism in terms of their character balancing, and it just frustrates me that. You know, there can be some lower characters that don't have the options that they need to justify having that low health. I think Capcom's balance or their approach to doing, you know, lighter characters or something is that if he's old, he has to be frail. Like, they take a look at the stereotypical character or they take a look at what would happen in an anime. It's like, oh, yeah, take a look at this character. He's going to be powerful. He's going to be a ninja, but... you know, he has to have low health because he eats one or two hits so long, that's it. They don't really... They don't put enough thought into some characters, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think also in certain terms, you have certain characters that bleed way too much, and then you have... Because they both do the variable life, they also do the variable damage.
Yeah.
So you get characters like Honda, who somehow end up having both. Fairly high health and... fairly high damage.
Oh, Vanilla Sagat.
Yeah, but you,
trade
mobility, except Honda has EX Headbutt, which, you know, gets him where he needs to go. But, and Sagat had, you know, Kara targeting.
Kara everything.
Yeah, Kara everything that I needed to do, which really fixed what limited Sagat in previous versions of Street Fighter titles, in that, you know, he didn't have the movement, but, you know, he could turtle and he could also zone.
Yeah.
And that's what a good Sagat is. A good Sagat will zone and will know how to keep you out, but, you know, you deserve to be punished when you get in.
Yeah. They'll try to shut you into oblivion. Basically.
That's why he's got that sort of health. He doesn't have an answer for everything, but he has enough to force a reset or to push you back to the point where you can go, all right, I've taken a little bit of damage, but let's see what we've got here. Let's reset it. But, you know, Gen doesn't have that. Once you're in on Gen,
you can
do anyone with a really high sort of vertical jump that doesn't have like a long arc that has a tall vertical one will fuck Gen up hard. And that's Chun. That's Chun and Bison specifically, because their air game beats out Gen, so there's no real way to go about it. But I don't know, anyone that can do ambiguous sort of cross-ups, Gen doesn't really have, even if he has an autocorrect DP, it's lighter than other ones, so it doesn't really work the same way as, say, Kami or Ryu.
What's the startup on his DP?
Is it 4 frames?
No, I think it's higher than that.
Yeah, it's higher than that. I honestly, off the top of my head, I don't know, because it changes per light, medium, and heavy, and EX.
Oh.
But,
so what's EX's startup, you know?
I think it's like 2.
Nah, it can't be 2.
It can't be 2. Because...
3 uses 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It should be 4 or 5, I think. I'm not so sure, but I'll check it.
It depends, because I've been beaten out before by slides from Rose and from Guy, well-angled timed slides against an EXDP with a whiff, but that's because of the no hitbox on the ground. And another property which frustrates me with Gen's DP is rather than being a traditional one, they gave it more properties like Balrog. They had the thought behind it where if you approach Balrog and he's on wake up, you can do crouching short or crouching jab and beat him out before the headbutt comes out on wake up.
But not EX headbutt.
Yeah, but not EX.
Yeah. But your EX catches my shot as well.
Yeah, it does. Except this is what frustrates me, is that Ryu and any Shoto with a solid meaty sort of medium punch will completely beat out, even if it's late, will beat out Gen's DP. It's the most... not EX, but Gen doesn't build the meter enough for him to be able to go, hey, I need to burn it. In vanilla, he had massive meter gain, so he was able to do EXs and stuff like that. But in super, he's got nothing that builds meter to the point where you can say, okay, I can use a lot of EX. He's not like Sakura where, you know, you can do a lot of block strength with Tatsus and stuff. His hands has pushback, so a lot of pushback, a lot more than it did in vanilla. And, you know, bread and butter combos which work in vanilla don't work in super because of, you know, tweaks to either his kicks or his hands.
So I was really thinking that in Arcade Edition they'd give him back, not the auger, but the hand combos at least.
I've been pretty vocal on SRK about the changes to Gen, and while some think it's okay, I think it's, you know, a quick fix to, you know, obviously Gen was further down in the development process and, you know, they had a time constraint on their hands, so they had to figure out something to really do. They gave a band-aid to a gaping wound in giving him target combos. That's not really what, you know, we wanted at all. It adds a nice little bit of damage and adds a little bit more meter gain on our combos, but you know, the DP is still broken, and his Mantis Jump Arc is, you know, they changed it from vanilla. He had a much more horizontal jump arc.
Yeah, that thing was like a missile. That thing was like so hard to anti-air.
It was like Abel's one. It had a really ambiguous sort of thing, and you could get in on charge characters like Guile and Chun-Li and you know, Bison. It was a fantastic tool at, you know, not just doing ambiguous cross-up, but establishing Mantis game. And they changed it to a Vega or Bison jump arc where, you know, it's this freaking high, and they didn't change the animations to suit it. So you still have these animations for Gen for a much more horizontal jump arc, but out of place in this giant vertical one. So you've got no ambiguous, you've got no safe jumps.
Yeah, you can literally see the cross up coming on.
You can see it a mile away, and there's no moves to, you know, hide it otherwise. So that's the most frustrating thing, is that jump arc is proof enough that they haven't thought about Gen to a point where, you know, he can be fixed. And they come back and they say, well, we don't have anyone that plays Gen at Capcom, so you know, tough luck. And, you know, the correct answer, you know, the counterpoke that I have and the Gen community has for it is that for the past, you know, nearly 4 years now, we've been, you know, developing guides and everything that needs to be done on SRK. And there's a thread now like 80 pages long where on the front page you can just see the basics of what everyone wanted for Gen's arcade changes. And, I don't know, Capcom just... It seems like Capcom US does a fantastic job at trying to listen to the community, and then Capcom Japan shafts all the good work that...
I think it has a lot to do with character popularity in Japan, because nobody in Japan also plays DJ.
No, I think it's not so much popularity. I think it's more what Capcom thinks. I don't think Capcom aims for overall balance like Sega does with Virtual Fighter. Like, they don't aspire to have a flat level tier list in that, you know, the bottom tier, if played well enough, will be able to compete solidly with the high tier. They want a broken game in terms of having super low tier characters, because, you know, you still got these people that have a lot of fun playing a low tier character and the challenge that comes with that. And then you've got people who don't really have it in them to use a low tier as their main, so they're more comfortable using someone who has the options there and, you know.
But I don't think that Street Fighter 4 has a super low tier, and I play Akai. I think it's much more balanced.
I think it's more balanced than previous Street Fighters, but it is still, but it is still not balanced enough, or they don't really do the right things.
Overall, I think it's probably one of the most balanced Street Fighter games in terms of anybody can beat anyone. But the problem that
I don't think anybody can beat anyone. I think there's a lot of characters that have matchups which, you know, are suicide. And but
that's
it depends
on ultimately. Still nothing compared to the matchups in ST, right? Which are like 0-82 matchups.
Yeah, but the thing with ST matchups is because it's high damage, you can still win.
Yeah.
Like Geek versus DJ in theory can be said 7-3-8-2.
Yeah.
But once when Geef gets in, I'm fucked. It's two SPDs, death.
Yeah.
But that's the problem with Street Fighter 4 is it takes so much longer to kill anyone.
Yeah, the matchups.
That's where the... And it's also Street Fighter 4, to me, tends to boil down to basically just normals. Because certain things beat out certain other things, and if your character has better normals than the other character, you usually tend to lose.
I think it's the most frustrating of the Street Fighter series today, in that... I don't know, techs don't seem... The way that you can just do assist tech, like, you know, down back, light kick, Kara into thing to have an option select for teching a grab is, you know, it takes that sort of challenge out of it. And just the startup, the much slower startup on normals is that if you have that lightning fast reaction for stuff, it doesn't work. You have to be thinking a lot more ahead. So you don't really have a safeguard if you have solid really quick reaction for that sort of shit.
I miss being able to whiff normals to bait stuff out.
It can still happen, but there's
whiffing a normal for the MP actually go out and do something, it feels like
it's too defensive in my mind. But I think from playing, you know, 3 days of Arcade Edition is that it doesn't feel as defensive.
Yeah, Arcade Edition I think is a huge improvement in overall area.
My character got nerfed.
Yeah, but he didn't get nerfed to the point where he's still unplayable.
Yeah, it wasn't like an unquestioned, it wasn't like a what the fuck nerf like Abel. Like Abel, yeah. I think deserved to be brought down a peg, but you know, Capcom don't really have subtlety in mind when they do something, you know. It's not like a slight change here for the entire cast to try and rebalance the tier list. You just have these, you know, mind-boggling stuff. It's like
sometimes you have swings.
That thing's broken. Let's change it five ways.
Just call Hagler the Nelcam.
But see, I think they finally got Guile right though. See, Guile went from vanilla, from being quite bad, to stupidly powerful.
I didn't think Guile was ultimately that bad in vanilla. He had the damage, and he still had the ability to zone. Right? It's just that he got. His Sonic Boom was too slow.
Yeah.
But they didn't really adjust that well for Super, but yeah, I think it's a lot better in AE. But, you know, the skill required for Flash Kick, FADC, Sonic Hurricane, which is not an easy thing to do, does way too little damage.
But you have to consider the fact that Gao can zone the shit out of a lot of matchups, and you give him a good FADC, it's kind of too powerful against some characters who can only get in once or twice a match.
That's
and
true.
If there's meter, he's safe.
I mean, the meter reduction was fine for me, but I still think that if you are to the point where you can go Flash Kick, FADC, and learn that sort of high-end sort of combo, there should be that just reward for learning a higher-end combo in having, you know, a suitable amount of damage to have it as something to be done in a repertoire, not to be, you know, outlawed because it's just way too low.
Okay. But I mean, you played AE for 3 days, so how many units did you play?
I played one, Akira's.
Akira's Yun.
And I didn't even know it was Akira. And this frustrates me because I dropped like 4 games. I got down to the last round on him like so many times. I got, I just thought, man, this is awesome. But Gen as a character has the options to beat out dive kicks, which really is fine for me. His standing medium punch in Mantis does a fantastic job at anyone that has sort of those low, sort of fast jump in arcs. So for Yang and for Yun, not so much Rufus, because Rufus has a very much more odd hitbox about him. But Yang and Yun can be kept out by Gen pretty solidly, and Gen's got the tools to really with an improved standing high kick, he can keep them out of distance between, say, Yang's wreckers or Yung's sort of, what's his punch?
Lunge punch.
Yeah. Yeah. Lunge punch.
Don't you mean guard punch?
But I think that does way too much. EX lunge punch into normal lunge punch is like, I don't know, it seems like 200 and around the 250 mark.
What about EX dash punch into ultra full screen and save?
I thought that's what lunge punch was. I thought the other one was the fireball one.
That's Yoho, I think. Yoho. Yeah. Yoho's the push.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I think Yun is... Yeah, I play a character that has a 5-5 matchup, so I can't say much, but I can say he definitely seems powerful. He's not as bad. I don't think he's as bad as Fei Long. I think Fei Long is easily the highest ranked person in the game. And, you know, I was playing with Ali Combo Maniac, and he was like, hey, check out what they gave him in AE, and, you know, there it is. There's a sweep off a standing jab, and I'm like, why the hell did he need this on top of his already high tier game that he already had? But
isn't it funny that back in vanilla, it was like you need FADC Ultra to be top tier. But yeah. In this game, like Fei Long doesn't have it, and he's still the best.
Yeah, that's because he's just got awesome startup on his wreckers, yeah. and he's got the zoning tools to really. Keep them out, and when they're in there, he's got, burn kick FADC backwards, and it's safe. So, he's safe all around, he's got safe normals, and he's got frame traps, he's got everything in the book that he needs to really do well. So if you're picking up Fei and you're losing, you're doing something wrong.
It's funny because I was playing Combo Maniac yesterday, and he was playing a Balrog, so I asked him, is that a bad match? He looked at me and said, yeah, no bad matches for Fei Long.
That's true.
So, you're from South Australia.
Yeah.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about the scene out in South Australia?
Out in South Australia? You say it like it's like, dingo whoop-whoop out in nowhere. But for you guys on the East Coast, Adelaide doesn't exactly pop up as a, go-to destination. But what I'll say about the South Australian community is that, we're not an established community. We lost, for those who don't know... is that arcades were outlawed by the Adelaide City Council for being unseemly or not desired into it as an establishment for where it is. And meeting people after SF4 came out, I've met about four or five people who played in the arcades back in CBD days, and they're still friends today, and they're good, they're close friends. So I don't know, I really want an arcade in Adelaide CBD, but talking just to have that solid meet point to keep a community focal point, but we don't have that. So what we have is the Adelaide Uni Video Game Society, which is EVAC, and that currently serves as our meet point for the Street Fighter and competitive players. But it's dropped off a bit since AE came out, and this is where it really hurts having an arcade release. I think it's fantastic for the arcade industry to have this sort of lifeline again with a high profile game so easily accessible. But for the communities that were founded in SF4 that don't have this access to things, they're starting to die off and they're starting to hurt a lot. Like, Marvel's come around, but Marvel's not everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah,
everyone wants to keep playing. And for the people that were stepping up and looking to go on a competitive scene, either nationwide or even had the thought in the back of their head that, hey, I might have fun going interstate and playing, if they know that their competition has 8 months ahead of play, they're gonna be pretty frustrated by the time they actually get to sit down and play it. So it's understandable why people drop off when they don't have access to this. And in terms of our numbers, I say we average around 20 competitive players, and then in terms of local week by week meetup, it's about anywhere between 5 and 10. and we used to have tournaments monthly, which used to bring people out of the woodwork, and they'd come along and play. They considered that, you know, justification to come into the CBD and play Street Fighter. But without those going around at the moment, you know, people have dropped off, and we still know that people are still playing Street Fighter in Adelaide and South Australia. It's just, you know, they don't seem as interested to come in and to still level up in the face of not having arcade edition, or, you know, for them it's playing the same people on a dated game. It's, you know, it's for everything that could make it fresh again, we don't have access to that right now, and we're suffering because of it. And I think, you know, any, I don't think we're alone. I think there would have to be other fledgling communities formed around the world that don't have access to AE. I think I was talking with Yep, the US Gen, like...
The former Gen Master.
He picked it back up recently, though, even though he doesn't have access to AE. And he's saying the same thing. He has concerns in his local community. But the difference there is that they have natural sort of enthusiasm and hype and, you know, bravado and buoyancy about what they do. So for them, meeting up and playing, even if it's not the latest version, they don't care. They'll just, like, laugh and have a good time and, you know, point jokes at each other. But I think we're a little bit more competitive to the core of our gameplay here in terms of Australia when it comes down to sport and when it comes down to any sort of competition, is that if you are putting in the time and the effort, you want to be able to do that on the same level as other people. You want that sort of fair, balanced aspect to it. And, yeah, so the Adelaide community at the moment is struggling a little bit. Hopefully, if any of them listen to this podcast right now, know that, you know, I'm still there every single week at, you know, EVAC. I'll bring my gear. I bring my, you know, my lag-free screen, my Xbox, my TE sticks. I bring everything when I can and honestly try and keep that sort of interest going for anyone that wants to play and still wants to learn. And, you know, considering we're not Melbourne or we're not Sydney, we don't have this establishment of super high tier, well educated players. We've got maybe 5 or 6 people that know the rundown, that know the vast history of fighting games and the mechanics and the mind games that go into it, and can tolerate losing and can tolerate getting beaten down here or there, and still have that drive, that edge to really better ourselves and to really come back and, you know, play again. But I don't know whether it's Gen Y or the recent generation, but a lot of them don't have that sort of competitive backbone about them. So, you know, if they're beaten down, they're not going to approach that person and say, listen, can you help me out? I want to know what I'm doing wrong. I want to get better.
I don't think it's even that. I think it's also the rise of casual gaming.
Yeah, and that as well. And fighting games are like RPGs in the point that you really need to invest your time to get through it.
Oh, no, no.
But unlike an RPG, say, where you invest 40, 50 hours and then you get to the end of it,
this is a decade-long process.
Yeah, this is a long-ass process to establish yourself. It is like an actual sport. It is an e-sport. You know, you can't just waltz in and go, hey, I'm top of the class here. Everyone kneel before me.
I think also one other thing is, because most of these guys have started off on consoles, you don't pay for the game. While most of the people who play in the arcades, you pay $1, you want to play your best, and you want to learn why you lost.
And that's why I love playing in the arcades. I felt more at home in Melbourne playing at Blue House and, you know, playing next to you guys at the Deakin Uni meetup, was because you guys were competitive about it. You know, you have that natural sort of flair for wanting to compete with one another.
So you also mentioned Marvel. So what do you think of Marvel 3 then? It's still new, still fresh.
Even though it's fresh and new, I can already see it's been built not in the way where you can have these high-end exploits are the way to go. You know, you've got 99 seconds, and this is what you see when you start out with Marvel, is that time over. You know, you're not going to get that damage out. And then you take a look at the high end of Marvel, and you see these people doing snapbacks, forcing someone into an infinite loop, like with Magneto and et cetera, et cetera. Yet there's not that in Marvel 3. What's in Marvel 3 is high damage and easy access to the high damage. So easy access for comebacks, easy access to really feel like you're powerful or you're skilled. So I think, you know, I've only played it maybe 3 or 4 hours, maybe a little bit longer than that. But my immediate impression of this game is, you know, it's fun to play and I love it, and, you know, I'll thrash it out to my heart's content. But even with the perpetual deep end that might come about, I still get this feeling that, you know, you're going to have more sigh moments, like, oh my god, Sentinel, there he goes, he's activated X Factor, there he goes, 100% health combo, and, or Dark Phoenix in my case, and, hey, I'm going to annihilate you, touch a death combo, and, I don't know, to me, you know, it's immediately fun, but I have issues on this, is that I don't see this being the same staple as Marvel 2 was for the Verse series. And, you know, if they balanced it and they brought back in snapback stuff and they toned down the damage, they toned down maybe from 100% stuff in a level 3 X Factor and they brought it down to, say, maybe 60 or 70%, then, you know, you would have much more of a fight on your hands. But, you know, to beat down two characters and leave them with one, that takes skill. And you deserve to be on the up. You don't deserve to have someone just activate something to, you know, increase their damage by 100% to have some sort of cheap-ass comeback. There should be, you know, if you've done the work, you deserve to be rewarded for that. You don't deserve for your opponent to go activate win button.
But see, I think that was
you have your own win button.
Yeah, true. That. But, you know, that shouldn't be it. That shouldn't be your, like, coup de grace, your saving grace. Your skill should be your saving grace, not just to go, bing, here we are, my back's against the wall, I'm going to activate this.
See, you know? I think the reason why they did that was because in Marvel 2, when you lost a character, or you lost two characters, it was basically game over.
Exactly.
It was like losing a limb in a fight. Yeah,
it is, and it should be like that. That's what Marvel is. It's not KOF where you can go, you know, get a little bit of health back at the end of each round if you do well with one character.
That's true.
You deserve to have that limb taken off, so you deserve to be crippled in a way. And the whole thing about Marvel is building a team that is cohesive together with their assists and with the way that they play with each other and back each other up. So you need to have that sort of mindset and stratagem about using three characters well enough together to really do well. So if you lose one, you should be at a disadvantage, and it doesn't feel like there's that sort of disadvantage to it. It feels very, very, it feels Capcom of late. It feels safe, you know. It doesn't feel like a, yeah, anyway, it just feels like even if you're three characters up and they activate X Factor, you've got Turtle. You need a Turtle, and you need to be defensive until that X Factor runs out.
The game basically slows down.
Otherwise, if you go guns blazing at that person who's got level 3 X Factor, you're going to lose one character, two character, then you're going to bring out your third and activate X Factor, and it suddenly becomes who can get in the two hits the quickest. So that's my immediate impression, but on the other hand, I think there is a lot of fun to be had in Marvel 3.
I think the game still has a fair bit of time to grow, but I've already seen certain strategies against the X Factor. Like, you build meter, and if they activate X Factor, you just keep them in basically block stun, even though it takes no damage. I've seen people just use 3 or 4 meters.
That's very much what I got from Toxie. I didn't get to play Carnage, and apparently Carnage is better, but you know, if you're an X Factor, you need to either have an awesome runaway game, but my own theory of countering X Factor is to Turtle and to know how to, you know, you need a really good defense for the high low block.
I think in this game, defense is going to be a hell of a lot more important because of the high damage.
There's the high damage, about five characters have teleport.
Yeah.
Where in Marvel 2, I think it was only Strider.
Yes, who had a teleport.
Well, apart from like, you know, Dalsim and Akuma and stuff like that, but Strider had the, you know, the really, really
ambiguous
you're fucked teleport. And Phoenix has that, you know, Spencer has it, Dante has it.
Dormammu sort of has it.
How is it ambiguous? You only appear behind him with Dante.
Yeah, but if you've got them in block stun, say with Doom's missile assist or something like that, you suddenly put, or you have Sentinels stuff coming in, you're forcing someone depending on your timing. to make a 50-50 guess at whether or not that first hit is going to be left or right. So depending on your timing, the first Sentinel hit, and I think this is what I found with Toxie. Toxie kept saying, no, you just need to block where I am. And I was doing that and anticipating where he was, yet he would time it with Spencer and the Sentinel assist, that the first Sentinel assist would always get, and then I would always get into a long string of combos. So near the end, I started going, all right, I'm going to block the first Sentinel assist right,
and then switch it.
And then switch it to where Spencer is. So that sort of game there, that's really, really powerful, and the characters that have teleport, I think, are going to be very, very strong.
Also, not to mention that if they come straight on top of you, before you have the guessing game whether the assist is going to hit you first or they're going to hit you first, and then if they don't hit you, they can also delay their hit so that they can throw you. It just becomes such a huge mix-up game when, yeah, it's a nightmare, basically.
Not just teleports, what about the dashing characters, like, you know, X-Men 3 or
Universal Air Dash not being in, I like. I don't know, it's hard to say, really. I think dashing is less in, you know, Marvel 2 is pretty much all about movement. It's, you know, if you're standing still, you're fucked. You know, you need to know how to dash, you need to know how to, you know, to try dash, to wave dash, to all this sort of stuff. But
in this game, not so much.
In this game, it's I think you're still going to need it, but try dashes aren't as strong as this.
Yeah, definitely. Because, they can only hit it from the top of the jumping arc. So, got any shout outs or anything else?
Alright, not so much of a shout out, but to anyone that's listening to this that's in South Australia, there's going to be a tournament at Adelaide Uni on the 12th of March. I think it's called Flood War, and it's going to be a round robin tournament for newcomers to be able to play one on their own without being knocked out. And we're raising money for the Queensland Premier's flood appeal. So all proceeds from this tournament will go towards raising funds for the Queensland flood victims, and there'll be prizes and stuff donated from local businesses and trophies and et cetera, et cetera. So 12th of March, and I think it will be at the Harry Medlin Rooms at Adelaide University or wherever EVAC can be held. So Union Cinema, I think, as well. One of those two.
Very, very cool. Very cool.
All right.
So thank you very much.
No problem, guys. Thanks a lot.
This is the Dono Deacon, and you're listening to Don't Be a Scrub podcast. Stay hungry, stay salty, and kiss my ring for respect. Once again, I'd like to thank Moose King for sitting down and doing the interview with us. I think this interview was actually quite a significant interview because we did cover a lot more than just fighting games, and I'm hoping to do a lot more interviews similar to this in the future. So, as always, stay hungry, stay salty, and thank you for listening.